Well, it is a great pleasure this afternoon to meet Anne-Sophie Ouattara. And Anne-Sophie, this is the first time that we've met, but of course, I've interviewed Rachel Jeffrey, who was very keen for us to have this conversation.
Wonderful person, and I'm very grateful to be here, very grateful to you and very grateful to Rachel, because nostalgia is a topic I'm very interested in. So I'm a teacher and I teach French literature and language. And I'm also, for another month, the National Portrait Gallery intern at the Beanie. So it's a partnership between the National Portrait Gallery and the Beanie to have an intern working in a museum. And for the past year, I've been working on exhibitions and curating and collections, and I have curated my first exhibition called Rooted in Fabric that closed last month, and it was an exploration of African and Black identities through fabric. So that's what I'm doing. That's what I've done, and at the moment, and this is my last project at the Beanie, it is Women's History Month. And I'm working on a little display on three remarkable women of Canterbury. One, Ellen Welby, is an artist specialised in ceramics. Women also that participated in the war effort during the First World War. So there was a hospital in Dame John's Garden. So I'm going to talk a bit about the nurses in that display, and also we received pictures from a lovely lady who had a grandmother who grew up in the region and was part of the Women's Royal Air Force and participated as well in the war effort in Canterbury.
It sounds like all the curation material, because obviously you're a teacher, you teach, is it French literature and language?
French literature and language, and also another little subject called theory of knowledge, which is not the theory of knowledge, not the branch of philosophy, but it's really critical thinking skills for
And is that secondary school?
Secondary school.
Yeah. And just before we started recording, we were talking about that notion of curation. I suppose we all sort of curate our own identities, or you actually work with the curation of artefacts, as you've just been talking about, which sounds so intriguing about the sort of the things that, you know, dealing with historical mementos. You were talking about, you know, the Second World War, for example. But it sounds like you've learned so much from that process in terms of gathering, I suppose, similar perhaps to what we're doing in this interview, almost sort of assembling people's lives or the various artefacts that may define them in a particular era and seeing how they resonate all these years on.
With people, especially, because when you curate, of course, you're going to get into the collections and try to find objects that are related to the topic or the person. You also have to write the interpretation and do a little bit of research, but you also need to find a way to touch and to engage the audience that we have today, which might not be completely interested in that particular topic, because most curators are a bit, you know, nerds, and we love history and we love the past, and we're really into that little bubble sometimes. And I think writing interpretation around these artefacts, after we've curated them, we selected them, is a way to connect the past and the present, and connect these objects and these artefacts to the audience and to the visitors who are coming to see the exhibition or the display.
Yeah, and that's such an important thing to do, because I'm somebody, as I was growing up, and even now to some extent, museums, you know, don't always appeal. And until I went to a museum, one of them was the Children's Museum in London, but also I went to Somerset House in London when they had a diary exhibition. This would have been in 2017. Now, I've kept a diary since I was 9 years of age, and you know, I write more and more, so it's like, you know, 2,000 words a day. It's a complete obsession. But I went to a diary exhibition and saw all of these different, you know, from different, you know, the famous diarists, you know, the sort of the Tony Benns and so on, but also the diaries that are anonymous, or the sort of somebody found on a skip sort of thing, and it's like the person may have died, or this was from 20 years ago and we came across it by accident, and then you see the dates on it, and you're thinking, what was I doing on that day? And, you know, well, I can easily find out. But you're looking at this and you're seeing this record, and then it was that lived history element that suddenly for me came alive and suddenly made me realize that, you know, I'm sort of doing something that's very bespoke to me, but sort of tapping into this wider history of biographies and revealing you know, things about oneself that one might not do in any other context.
Yes, and that's something that people do when they visit an exhibition, that sometimes they are surprised. Yeah. Museums can are sometimes not really appealing, and then you see an object that you can relate to, or you see that the pain of this artist, or the joy of this artist, or the memories of these artists are things that you can relate to. And I think that's what happened with these journals for you. But I'm surprised. I'm the complete opposite. I love writing, but I hate writing about myself, and I don't like... I tried, because I love literature, of course. Obviously, I teach it, I studied it, and I do like biographies. I do like autobiographies. I do like reading journals. So I do like getting into people's lives, but examining my own through writing. I try to keep a journal. I really wanted, like my idols, to keep a journal and just be regular and write every day. And I could never do that. I think the maximum entries I've had is maybe 2 or 3. Yeah. And then I would just give up, because it's not the way I reflect. Oh, that's not the way I analyse my feelings, really.
You see, I think you touch on a really important point, which is, why would somebody... Effectively, we use the word curate, because that's obviously pivotal. That's the very obvious link between us. Why do people curate their lives? And I wonder whether, certainly in my case, is it like a corrective against bad memory? So that, you know, if in the future I sort of, you know, start to, you know, it's almost like I have a corroboration of something that I think I know, and it can ground me. But I think there's something else, which is, I think it's born out of periods in my life when sometimes I felt maybe there's a narrative that I don't agree with, or whether maybe I'm in a conversation with somebody and I feel maybe I'm not able to articulate very well my concern. The diary is a way of putting all that down. So it's almost as though, you know, there are very dominant voices in the world. And sometimes you feel, well, you know, no one's going to listen to mine. But at least through the diary, I can say what I want in my words, in my own terms. And that often, of course, involves interacting with others. Or I'm obviously putting their point of view. Or I might even, in some cases, be incorporating emails or WhatsApp messages or whatever it might be. You know, so that as part of it, like, oh, I received this email from somebody. And, you know, but I'm effectively putting it into a context. And the reason I could never get bored with doing it and never give up doing it is because, in a way, there's something very emancipating about doing that. And I'm wondering, so it might be that in your case, a diary or a journal is not your thing, but you will have other outlets for doing the same sort of thing, I would imagine.
I love photography. I love making images. I don't make art per se, and I do write on my free time, and it comes from my background. I have a master's in legal history, and I'm always interested in history, and the writing I enjoy doing is mostly linked to research, so not my feelings, but I do enjoy taking pictures of pretty much everything. Yeah. I do.
Animate objects, inanimate, or both?
Both. Yeah. And also making videos. And just like, I think you interviewed Rachel not so long ago, and it's a way to relive that memory. And I think, to me, it's a sensory experience that helps me remember and reflect on past events, which is something that I can't really do through writing. Because I would be too, and it might be because I've always wanted to be a curator, and I'm a curator now, and I hope being able to curate in the future. But in terms of diaries and biographies, and I look at your shelves here, and you have quite a few, and I have a biography from a very famous historical character in France, and I'm always a bit suspicious. Because I think, especially when you write a diary, there's also this idea that, you know, and I discuss this with students, because I'm also looking at biographies with some of them in French literature. There's this idea that, you know, it's your legacy and posterity. And I don't know really the part of ego that gets into that writing. Mm-hmm. And to me, there's always that suspicion that it might be inauthentic. Yeah. Well, when you take a picture, that's the picture and that's it. I mean, that's still this. I mean, you can still edit it now. Mm. So it's a bit different with technology. Yeah. But yes, I do I do take sometimes personal writing with a pinch of salt.
Yeah, I think you really hit the nail on the head, because I just saw the new Spielberg film, you know, the Fablemans. I don't know if you've seen it.
But, I haven't watched it, no.
But very autobiographical, but it sort of really gets to the heart of the way that, in his case, growing up, his way of dealing with all the various sort of difficulties or traumas growing up of being bullied at school or his parents separating was to, in his own terms, make a film. But in some cases, of course, he'd be, through editing often, exaggerating certain things or making, you know, not very nice people in a much nicer light. But that was a way of shaming them. Like at school, he was bullied. He was, you know, there was obvious anti-Semitism there. But he did a video, and actually the best way in which he could possibly almost embarrass the other person is to make them look like a god sort of thing. And then it was like, and it was that element of, on his own terms, he was able to filter somebody's life. So sometimes the movie, the picture, unless I do it, because on Facebook, I'm always putting my own sort of images out there. But sometimes you, not manipulating, I would never manipulate the picture, so it's clearly me, but I might do the lighting. Or I might make the picture a bit sharper. And I've got pictures of me at university, so like from the early 90s, like photographs of photographs that I've you know, carefully curated. And I've made the, not necessarily intentionally, but just to make the picture look sort of sharper, the grass is greener and the sky is bluer. So people sometimes said, gosh, those were happy days because you had, you know, the green grass and the blue sky. But I think, yeah, but the actual original image is a bit grey. But it's interesting that part of the way of looking back on the past is, of course, to accentuate those bits as it suits our purposes. So, yeah, what you're saying is fascinating.
And I think we were talking about it before we started the interview, and I was talking about how memories are really in layers, and what I like about pictures is that sometimes you have something that comes back up that you might have completely forgotten, so you just relieve it in a different way depending on, you know, how you feel that day, and that's what I like about pictures, about my pictures, but also about other people's pictures. Because that's what I do, and that's like what I've done with the exhibitions I've worked on, so all the works. So the first exhibition, and that was the object of my internship, but my main mission was to work on an exhibition called Mirror Mirror. And that was very interesting because it really lined up with the ethos, really, and the objectives of the Beanie, which is diversifying their collections. The idea of Mirror Mirror was to look at who we used to admire and revere in the past, and who we are admiring today, and also try to acknowledge the gaps that were in that history, because what I was saying about curating, especially in museums, is a question that is, and that we constantly discuss, because we discovered that in our collections in the Beanie, most of the people that we were remembering were rich, white, and powerful. And the very few women we had were there because they were their wives. So part of the objective of this exhibition was to acknowledge that there were gaps. And of course, there were other people that were forgotten. There were people of color. And we acknowledge them by having blank frames, because of course we did not have, unfortunately, any artifacts or any portraits, and some women as well. And what we did, we tried to correct a bit the problem in this gap, is that we asked the community in Canterbury and Kent to nominate people, and we commissioned new portraits of people who played a role in the community, mostly from groups that were not really represented in museums. So we have now a fantastic portrait, and that links to university, of Dr. Rawi, who was the Imam of Canterbury Mosque. So it's right around, it's not around the corner, but it's really quite close. And he actually participated in building the mosque that you have now near the sports centre.
Yeah, on Giles Lane, anybody who's living in Canterbury.
Because when he arrived here, and he was a student, and then he taught, there was no mosque. There were only a handful of people in the 70s. And he did all that community work, all that interfaith work as well. So he's very important local figure, but that a lot of people even here didn't know until his portrait was made by a fantastic artist. Her name is Orianne Pierpoint, and she's a young artist. I think she's going to be a great artist. She's already a great artist, but she managed to just paint him in a way that shows his personality and his energy. And it's very faithful, very realistic. It's fantastic. And we also have a drag queen and a Paralympic athlete. So they were represented in that exhibition. And the main goal is to have them in our permanent collection and in the galleries, along with other portraits that usually represent quite the same people.
And I'm wondering, I mean, that just sounds amazing, because I'm also thinking that a few decades ago, those works were not being curated, or at least, or were they? Or were they sort of being curated, but in a way that wasn't sort of representative of the sort of majority of the outputs?
Yes, I mean, we mostly commissioned them because they did not exist at all. Yeah. It was really, really hard to find a portrait of a black person or a portrait, but that's because they were in positions and because of oppression, of course, and white supremacy. It was absolutely impossible to have them represented anywhere unless they were, I don't know, a servant and they were next to a white person, for example. Or if, in the very few portraits that we have, not in our collections, but in collections in general, are because an artist would get interested in a particular person, but sometimes these, and I'm talking about people of colour, don't necessarily have a name. We don't even know who they are. So these works did not really exist, but we do have artists who have tried to represent the population, their diversity, and that's what I want to do as a curator, is to try to look for these works and look for these people who haven't been recognised as artists and their work and bring them to museums.
And is this something, I know the answer to this question, but it's obviously something that you want to continue to do. But I'm also interested in exploring sort of the journey to where you are now, because it sounds as though you found this perfect kind of synthesis almost. You know, it's like you're doing the dream job, but you're doing it and it's invaluable. What's clearly in this is that it's necessary that you're effectively bringing to light and helping to cultivate the sort of, you know, exhibits which once upon a time either didn't exist, or if they did exist, we simply didn't, you know about them, and so there's a sense of retrieving the past and putting it on a pedestal and saying, you know, look at this, you know, this is
it is worthy yeah. And it is something that is worth looking at. And I like the idea that I'm on a podcast and discussing nostalgia, because it is not something that is fixed. I think 10 years, 20 years ago, my idea of, you know, when I used to go in a museum, most of what I was seeing was classical art, or art mostly made by white men, mostly wealthy. And I really thought for a long while that it was what art was. And that art made by other people simply did not exist because they were either not artists or not worth being represented. And I think museums also participate into what we think is our collective identity. And I think bringing these works are also going to change people's perceptions of what the past was and how their ID and their nostalgia for a particular time might not be as accurate as they think it is.
Yeah. And in your own case, do you want to say a little bit about your background? Because you grew up in France, is that right?
Yes. So I was born in Lille in 19...
I didn't ask that question.
And yes, I've always been passionate about art. I've always been passionate about literature as well. And curating is always something that I had been interested in. And music as well. I don't come from a musical family, and that's actually an object that I could have brought. because I'm a flutist.
Mm.
Not really, not very good. It has to do with nostalgia as well. I wanted to play the double bass or the piano, but I had a mother who was really nostalgic about her time in a family where there was someone playing the flute, so I had to play the flute. And that was the first thing I had to do because my parents were nostalgic. And yes, it came from her own memories and her own nostalgia. So I wanted to study art history, but couldn't. Unfortunately, my dad was a barrister, a very serious one, passionate about literature and art as well. But he always saw that as some kind of hobby.
Do you know, so many, and also because I used to be a senior tutor in this very building, and would deal with students and their sort of pastoral concerns, and occasionally, and it would be heartbreaking, particularly when a student was perhaps not doing as well as they once had done, or something. It's like, well, we know what's happened, and they might say, you know, my father, and often it was the father, would say, oh, I don't want you to do this, or I want you to do this instead, or I'm not supporting you to do this, or I'd rather you at least take this module rather than that module. And that sort of level of intervention ended up with the child saying, I'm sorry, you know, that just wasn't working out, and it was so sort of counterproductive. And isn't it interesting? And I'd often say to them, you know, so, you know, when I'd hear them say, oh, you know, my father doesn't think I should do this, not that. And I said, you know, did they go to university? As in, you know, how much do they know about the syllabus? You know, I was trying to work out, that's a very micro level kind of, sort of, you know, element. I mean, you know, I can't imagine, I'd always be, my children are very young, but I'd be very interested in what they were doing, but I certainly wouldn't intervene. And the answer was often no. So it's almost as though maybe that if their, you know, parents hadn't been to university, that the parents were projecting onto their children some of the things that, you know, they wish they'd done. Although it sounds in your case as though actually it was not quite like that, because it was actually wanting you to do the things that they had done and about which they were very nostalgic, and wanted you to carry on in that tradition, family tradition.
Exactly. I think he maybe wanted to have some kind of dynasty of barrister. And it also comes from the fact that I think law, in particular for him, was a life saviour. So he started studying in West Africa. He was born in Africa, from a poor family. My grandparents did not go to school. So he was the first to go to school and the first to go to university. And the only reason I'm here, and I was born in France, is because at the time he got his master's, there was an opportunity for the first, I think, the two best students to come to France. So he was one of the best, and he came to France and he got the career that he had. So I think it was very important for him to have someone to continue. And I think I kind of, at the time, I was quite young, and I thought, you know, maybe this is what I need to do, this is what I should do. And also because, and I think museums have changed and collections are changing and curating is changing, and I want to be part of that, and I want to be part of that change. I think part of me might have thought, oh, maybe curating is not for me,
yeah,
or being in a museum is not exactly for me, because a lot of curators still in the profession and in museums is still full of, you know, posh white people who studied in prestigious universities. It's still not very diverse. So maybe I thought that this is what I had to do, because maybe I did not, even though I had the talent and I had very good grades and I was an excellent student and an avid reader, and I had, and I still have, piles and piles and piles of art books, and reading lots and lots of literature and art criticism and philosophy. So I had all it took, but I thought that maybe I did not really belong. And I think it's not this bad that it took me some time to get where I am now and to get that experience, because all this experience and what happened in the past decade or more, I think I can feed into this new profession I want to get into. So I went to law school. Despite the fact that I wanted to study art history, I got a master's in legal history. So I kind of decided at that time that, you know, history was for me, because I always wanted to do some history. So I did enjoy that year because that's the year I did research. And I started writing, really, and do some serious academic writing. But that's not really what I wanted to do. So I moved on to languages.
Do you know, I find, and this applies in my case as well, it's almost as though you end up doing, or if you don't end up doing it, you will regret not doing it. The things that you're sort of, you know, that you're almost born to do, in the sense that, you know, we all have talents of different sorts. And sometimes the way to really know whether you're a good fit for a particular, whether it's a profession or relationship or whatever the context is to go through it and to also experience alternatives. I mean, I've only ever worked in the university sector in that sense. I went to university at 18 and never left, kind of thing. But in my case, there's always been other sort of dreams that I've never really cultivated. Radio was always the one. And so the podcast is probably, you know, the equivalent of doing that. But it's interesting that what's coming up from your narrative is the clear sense that you've almost always known what you wanted to do. You were maybe discouraged from doing it, but now you're doing it with even greater fervency because you know it's the right thing and you're doing it, you know, perhaps later than would be ideal.
Yes, but as I said, it's really, yes, I'm just bringing all that experience, all that life experience, all that culture as well, and all that knowledge, because I do feel like to be a good curator, you need to be interested in everything that goes on around you. And the fact that I've been a law student, I've done legal history, then I moved on to English, because English was also something I really enjoyed. And also that my mother, just like the flute, really, really liked. I think she wanted to be an English teacher, but she didn't manage to be a teacher. She had to stop university quite early. So I moved to English, and then I came here. And it's really a mix of, I kind of knew what I wanted to do. I wasn't sure if it was possible, and just quite a bit of luck, I think.
Yeah.
And just seizing opportunities where they were. So I came here, and I was actually nostalgic. When I received that email and when Rachel said, oh, she's super interesting, you should interview her. I spent a year here, and it has been a life-changing year. I don't think that if I had came home, it would have had the same impact. I came here, I realized that I wanted to stay here, and I found a job here. That changed everything, and that changed my path.
And it changes the apprehension of the, you know, we all have our own origin stories, obviously, but in that sense, it's the way that you harness it. It's the way that you rework that notion of home, of belongingness, of nostalgia. Of course, nostalgia is that longing for home. And I suppose you can long for something, but also you can be aware that, you know, well, nostalgia is absolutely bittersweet, isn't it? It's not just a, you know, you reflect in some cases a very mournful sense that, you know, maybe you've changed, maybe the place has changed, and it's that disconnect between maybe the ideal and the real that actually makes you feel very ambivalent about it. But sometimes the way forward is literally the way forward, rather than to try and imagine that you can somehow return to what may or may not once have been wonderful decades earlier.
Yeah, so they do feel like there's always space to reinvent yourself, and actually use nostalgia and use these memories, and especially positive memories, and try to recreate them elsewhere or in another context. So everything I liked, from literature to research to art, in another place, I managed to recreate some kind of world and some kind of home with these memories, but elsewhere, which is here. So I just took with me all these elements, and all these elements I was fond of when I was younger. And yes, I'm trying to recreate some kind of place or some kind of home that have all these ingredients in the present.
Has your understanding of home changed to the point that the place where you grew up is no longer sort of recognisably somewhere that you would even want to return to anymore?
Yes, because I come from, and I think it's really the history, it's my history, but also the history of my family, a history of really moving around and being displaced. And my mother was born in Togo, but then my grandfather was a footballer, so they were moving around. And when he died, she went from one country to another. So she spent some time in Switzerland and then in Germany. And then in France, my father is a bit of the same. He was born in Burkina Faso, and then he traveled a bit when he studied. And then he came to France, where he found a new home. And then they both met there, and they made a home there. And then they separated, and they made the home elsewhere. And myself was between two homes for a while, and then I moved to study, and then I moved here to England. So we spent quite a lot of time individually and also as a family, and then me moving around a lot. So I do feel like home is not really a place or a geographic place. Yeah. It's more what you bring with you. And that's why I was saying about recreating and just taking all these memories or all these needs and all these desires or ambitions with you, and carrying them with you, and then finding the right place where you can sit with all this. So, yeah, my understanding of home has constantly changed throughout my life. And I still think that I'm on a journey, to find home and the real sense of belonging that goes with it. I found part of it when I came here, and I think that's the reason why I wanted to stay. But I think I still have some work to do in order to really feel at home somewhere.
And are you on this journey, or have you been on this journey with anyone else, siblings, or is there a sense, are you in touch with people from that, in that era? Or is there a sense sometimes of needing to sort of have a new, sort of lots of different like new beginnings? How do you navigate that past?
I do have some contacts with the people I was in law school with, but it's, one of them, and we're very close. Maybe it's part also of my personality. I'm a loner, and I like being in a bubble, and I like new beginnings, and I like all the feelings that go with new beginnings, where you just come into a place with all these feelings and all these ambitions and all these desires, and you want to create something new. So, I think that sometimes to start over, you need, at least temporarily, to just move away from some places or some people, which doesn't mean that you can't go back there. I've had a couple of people that I've known who got back in touch with me. But it's a bit odd, and I'm a bit ambivalent, because I have fond memories of being around them. But also, I'm not the same person, and they're not the same people. And there's also this apprehension. I'm not the same, they're not the same. So basically, we're strangers with a past in common. And the thing is, you were talking, and we were talking about nostalgia. Their memories might not be exactly the same, and their feelings about the past might not be the same as mine. So there's this element of awkwardness that I'm a bit afraid of. And that might be the reason why I haven't gotten in touch with a lot of people from my past.
Yeah, I was in a period in my life when, to put it sort of diplomatically, I wasn't doing the sort of stuff I'm doing now. My dream might have been to do something like this, but I was not in the right place in my life. And I was contacted. I think I was doing some external examining at another university, and a friend of mine from university friended me on Facebook, even though I wasn't really on Facebook. It was more that I had a nominal. I think a student once set up for all of the staff, just so that we could be in touch with, in the days when it was sort of thought like, that's what teenagers do. They go on Facebook, as it turns out that maybe that's not what teenagers do now. So effectively, I had a Facebook account that I never used. And then I was contacted by all these people from decades earlier. And it was all like, yo, Chris, how are you doing kind of thing? And I was like, I can't do this. And actually, at that moment in time, I couldn't do it. But a few years later, when circumstances changed, again, putting it diplomatically, then I was very, very comfortable re-engaging with these people. But it was sort of where there was a better alignment. And also, when you're at a stage where you actually feel sufficiently confident in yourself, that, I mean, I'm very, very comfortable. Somebody who I work with here actually said that I'm probably like a shy extrovert. And I thought that was a very interesting way of putting it, because there's that need to promote or disseminate or publish the sort of stuff that I do. I need to perform. But also, it also slightly goes against my personality, because I'm somebody who would be much more comfortable putting something about myself on social media in terms of what I wear or where I'm going than I might sort of do in sort of day-to-day interaction. So there is that sense sometimes that sort of fulfills the sort of the missing bit. But everything has to align. And if it doesn't align, then actually being contacted by people from your past could be the worst thing, because it would be traumatic, because you're just not in that place psychologically.
And it just brings out memories that you might not be ready to process. It reminds you of a time that might not be the happiest. I did not really like those kind of surprise. That's the thing I like being in control quite a lot. And I think it has also to do with curating, because curating means that you make choices and you are in control of the narrative because you're going to curate, you're going to write the interpretation. And I like being in control of what I do, of my feelings as well. And having random objects or random people coming back doesn't necessarily align with what I want. So we'll see about these people.
Yeah, but also you've touched on something really important there about being in control of the narrative. And we were saying a bit earlier in the conversation about diaries. And I think that when you have very dominant voices in any discourse, it can happen in politics, it can happen indeed among work colleagues here, where sometimes there is a particular like a dominant approach and you feel sometimes my voice is not being heard. I find that the diary will be a record of often what those people are saying and how I feel about it and how I just feel that, you know, I don't belong in this community, or, you know, that there are people saying things that make me feel unwanted or unloved or whatever. 5 years on, and you reread some of those, and then you look at maybe what's happened subsequently and how maybe their narratives have changed, or maybe they this is the crucial bit, they may even claim never to have said the things that they say. But because the diary is a contemporary record, as in you write it either on the day or the following morning, then if you say, I had a conversation with somebody, this is what was said, then, you know, somebody can't say, oh, I never said that. It's like, well, you know, I wrote that on the day that it was said, kind of thing. And or maybe in some cases you'd also include supporting stuff like, you know, I got this email or something. So for me, the diary is not just sort of important on the day, it's also without knowing who might find it useful in the future. Maybe no one, of course.
Maybe a curator, and that's what I like, and that's what I would have liked doing and having with me. So I talked at the beginning of this interview about that display about Women of Canterbury, and these nurses and this woman from the RAF. I would have liked having journals or diaries and just know, you know, there are these bits of micro history that are also quite important to just shed light, especially when we talk about a big event like the war. Or, you know, maybe a historian could be interested in your diaries in the future. You know, I don't know about what you have written during COVID. But yes, there are important elements of micro history that for historians and curators are sometimes crucial.
And I think it's funny you mentioned COVID, because I mean, COVID certainly had an impact on my ability to do these interviews, in the sense that I ended up doing them online. And actually, the positive is that I ended up interviewing people in New Zealand and Canada and all places of the world that I would never have had a chance to do if I was just interviewing people in my office. But what it also did is it's, for me, you know, the so-called COVID diaries are great, except you also need to have as a counterpoint, what were you doing before COVID? So people who started writing diaries during COVID is very illuminating and will be illuminating in the future, but not as illuminating, I would argue, as that sense of, okay, you were doing this in March or April 2020 and onwards.
Because you've had nothing else
to
do.
But what were you doing in 2019, 18, 17, 16? And for me, you know, almost that sort of that game on this day in history, whereby you're thinking, you know, for me during COVID, it was a case of, well, I'm stuck here. I mean, as it turned out, the politicians were having a whale of a time and partying. and at the time, I was following the rules. And it was like being a prisoner in some cases. I couldn't go out. All the sort of things I love doing, I go to work every day. I go to the cinema. I do all sorts of things. I couldn't do any of those things. And often the diary would all show that, you know, a year before I was going and meeting people, I was going to see all these great events. So the diary, I think, is always contextual. So anybody who started their diary during COVID, you know, that's great. But for me, you unless you actually carry on doing that diary, or that there's a diary that precedes it, then I think that without the context there, it doesn't really give you as much of a flavour as
otherwise it would. Yeah. Years.
So the importance of micro history in all of this.
Yes, and also people's lives and people's, but even, and I'm going to go back to Mirror Mirror and that exhibition, we also had a community project where we had a photographer who came and took pictures of members of the public. So we had visitors coming into the museum and we would take pictures of them because they were also a reflection of Canterbury at that time and they were featured in the exhibition, and it's just anonymous people who suddenly became part of an exhibition that usually features, only famous works of art. And they were asked, who are you and what do you want to be remembered for? And you had all sorts of answers besides, you know, I want to be remembered for loving my family or, you know, being kind. You had quite a lot of people talking about, yeah, their significant other or what impact they want to have on the community. That was quite interesting. And I feel like years from now, on top of these new commissions, we will have also people, everyday people, who could be featured in an exhibition, because it's just a glimpse of, you know, what the population looks like at a particular moment.
And do you think you've, and it sounds like you have you transformed lives? Have you changed people's expectations? Have people come to you and said, thank you for that exhibit, or thank you for curating that? I mean, are you aware of the impact of what you're doing on people?
We had a lot of feedback for that exhibition of people being very moved to see these new portraits, to see themselves as well, for the people who were part of that community project. Also for the exhibition that I have curated. So it was the first time there was an exhibition, at least in Canterbury, about Black identities and African identities. And I really tapped into my own nostalgia, because the idea was to present what African fabrics were and also what wax fabric was. So, you know, that very colourful fabric that you see a lot of African people wearing, and that is synonymous with Africa. But the idea of the exhibition was to explain that it wasn't really African, and it was really the result of the relationship between Africa and the West during the colonial period. So I tried through that exhibition to just tell people this is what traditional fabric looks like. And also this is this fabric that is the result of, you know, history, and how the British and the Dutch basically appropriated a process that existed in Africa and Indonesia, kind of industrialized it, tried to sell it back to Africa, and then was reappropriated by African people and became part of African identity. So it featured quite a lot of pictures, old pictures and new portraits. And also I tried to discuss how people wear it every day, how it is used by artists to tap into their own memories. So you have quite a lot of artists using the fabric or using these patterns to discuss and to pay tribute to their African identity. Yeah. It's also something that you find a lot in mainstream fashion. So it is fabric with a history and a future. And we had quite a lot of feedback because it was quite new. We had very positive feedback from visitors because visually it was very appealing. It was very colourful. It was beautiful. But also you had this audience that didn't know anything about the past and that past and might have had an idea of colonization that they've read in books or they've seen in documentaries. But this is part of the history of colonization that people might not know. So you have these people who used to go to museums and learn something new because it's not something that is often approached in museums. You also had people, and that's what touched me the most, who said that it reminded them of their memories.
Yeah.
So you had people who were born in Africa and just like my parents, emigrated in Europe and had fond memories of seeing traditional fabrics or wax fabric when they were younger, and just seeing that in an exhibition in a museum was very moving because, you know, it was to them it was an everyday thing, but maybe not something that they would expect to see in museums, and see all that history and see where it comes from, and see how culturally significant it is, and the fact that it is in a museum, because for a lot of people, if it is in a museum, it means that it matters. And seeing that their own culture matters was very important. And I've tried to make it accessible also for children when I've curated it. So there was this possibility of drawing and also weaving. And you had quite a lot of children who were very happy to draw their own patterns and just be their creative selves. So overall, it was quite good to see how different audiences reacted to that exhibition. I curated and researched, and I didn't really expect to have that impact originally, and I'm very grateful to the Beanie. Originally, it was just supposed to be a small display in a case.
Yeah.
And then I pitched 3 pages of how it was important, and they gave me the front room of the Beanie, which is the first thing you see when you come into the museum. It's the first gallery, really. And I'm very grateful for that opportunity to do that project and have so many people relating to it.
And do you think this is something that you're going to have the opportunity to continue to do? Because I know that you said that your present contract, or, you know, is running out.
Yes, I hope so. And I will go back to the Beanie again, because I'm very grateful for that opportunity. But it's also because I've been for the past year in an environment where people worked and did things that aligned with my values.
Yeah.
And it was, and I'm saying this, it's not done yet, but I will be gone at the end of the month. And being in such a positive and nurturing environment, I think gave me a lot of confidence to continue doing this. I know that I'm capable of doing it because, of course, I didn't know that I could do it before. I knew I could write. I knew that I had a lot of knowledge in terms of art history, because despite the fact that I couldn't do everything I wanted to do and I couldn't study it and I don't have a formal diploma, I have swallowed quite a lot of books, of exhibitions, of really discourse around curating and exhibitions. So I've done that. It was successful. And I do have quite a lot of ideas and projects I would like to do. Yes, I just need to find, and you were talking about home, I need to find the right home for it. So I need to find a gallery or a museum that would be happy to have me as a curator, so I could continue, doing those kind of projects. And yes, and get people who don't usually go to museums come to museums and be able to relate and not be afraid to go, because all they're going to see is just going to be art that they might not relate to or not understand. Or, and I think that's even worse, going to a museum and know that, you know, your culture doesn't really belong there. Yeah. Or who you are doesn't really belong there, despite the fact that you know that your ancestors have a history. So, yes, I will try. Yeah. I want to try. I want to do that. It took me almost more than a decade to get into this place. And, of course, I would like... I want to. I will do everything I can in order to pursue that. And that's what I want to do with Rachel in the future if we have the occasion of doing this. And that's why I will try to find a place as a curator.
Yeah.
And maybe in the future, I mean, maybe not have my own museum. That would be a bit
much.
Wow. No, but at least, I don't know, maybe my own gallery.
Yeah.
Because, you know, we were talking and we did talk about nostalgia a lot. But what I liked about what I've curated with Rooted in Fabric is that part of it has to do with nostalgia in the past, but also part of it was oriented towards the future and what artists are doing at the moment with the fabric and how they feel about it and how what it was in the 19th century is not what it is now.
Well, that's what I was going to ask, because just as we start to wrap up, I've got a few more sort of more philosophically basic questions. But I mean, there's that question about, you know, whether your memories are sort of positive, and twinned with that whole question about what you do with those sort of negative experiences. Can you be nostalgic for them? In other words, are we always rewriting our past, reframing our past? So in terms of your profession, that's a really good question, an important question, I think, because there's that sense that maybe you have a chance to retrieve the past. That was the word that you used earlier. And in so doing, maybe in some ways not necessarily make peace with the past, but at least you're able to perhaps see the past in a different and better way because you have some autonomy, some control over it.
Yes, and I think it and that's why it is important to have diversity in curating as well, because it is a history we know. I want to do this job and I want to keep curating, mostly because what I know, what I've learned, because I was born in France and I grew up in Europe, is such a negative, quite horrible history. And, you know, black history and African history and culture are always and were always, at least for a long while for me, painted in such a negative light. So the idea is not to erase the oppression, not at all, but is to show how resilient and how creative my ancestors were.
Yeah.
And it's not just a history of pain and a history of oppression. We have made great contributions to world history. We have created great art and great music, and that's something that belongs in collections and museums and that needs to be acknowledged among the other works and the other people and historical figures that are already acknowledged. So it's really making space for these narratives and these stories.
I was just thinking, because you're talking about the war, my grandfather in his 80s and 90s wrote, and they're all in my in the very office where we are now, he wrote various, you know, a story of how he met my grandmother during the Second World War. And of course, at the time, you know, he would have been going through suffering. He would have been going, you know, you never knew if you were going to live to see the next day kind of thing. And yet he's got this lovely romantic story about how they met and everything that followed. And it's interesting because he was writing that 70 years after it happened. And that for me is so insightful, because at the time there would have been so many unknowns, so much uncertainty, so much suffering. And although all of that sort of appears in the memoir, it also is suffused with this sort of sense of, you know, I'm you know, because if it wasn't for the war, he wouldn't have met his wife, my grandmother, kind of thing, and I wouldn't be here today. So you know, there are lots of different lenses for looking at a past event, and it sounds as though, you know, you've got this amazing sort of opportunity, and you've been doing it with such aplomb to actually try and revisit, rediscover, retrieve the things that were just not allowed to be part of the conversation a few decades ago. Not so much allowed; they just weren't there. They weren't even, people weren't aware of them. People weren't discussing them. Museums didn't have those exhibits.
And now they're starting discussing them more and more. And yes, by being a curator, and because it was my dream even before retrieving all these memories and all this art made by people of color or indigenous and native and women, of course. But I want to be part of that conversation, and I do feel like I have a contribution. And even from the point of view of my personal history, I know a lot about retrieving, interpreting the past, and I think that's something I can bring into into my job as a curator.
And what do you think your younger self would have thought, like, you know, just say your teenage self, would have thought about what you're doing now? Or what did your younger self imagine that you'd be doing? I mean, I know we mentioned law earlier as things that perhaps you didn't want to do, or, you know, or the flute. But you know, what?
I did want it to be a musician yeah. for a while. I don't know why my mum thought that it would be a good idea to let me watch Amadeus when I was quite young.
Oh, the Mozart film. Oh, my yeah. God. I saw that at the cinema. I was very young. I don't think I understood it at all.
Me neither, but I really did enjoy the music, and I do, and I'm still very, very fond of classical music. And I'm actually going to go to a concert after this interview. Yeah, I'm going to Wigmore Hall to listen to famous, now, harpsichordists. I'm still very fond of classical music, and a part of me wanted to be a musician, I think, and I'm very into music history and musicology as well. So I think my younger self would be proud, I think. Mm. I hope so, because I managed. She would be even proud of me being a teacher, yeah. Because I never imagined I would be one. I remember when I was a teenager, I had my teachers in front of me, and I think I thought, I will never do that.
Yeah.
That I would never be a teacher. And I'm a teacher, and I'm very comfortable in the classroom, and it's just having this relationship with the students is just so amazing. And I found, before curating, a way to bring that knowledge, bring that joy, bring that love of learning and that love of history and that love of art, and just, you know, do that work of transmission. So I think it was a good transition between law and curating. So I think she would be proud of me as a teacher. She would be proud of me as a curator, yeah. even though it wasn't exactly what I wanted yeah. to do. I think
yeah.
she would be proud because this is, you know, everything we like, we actually made it a job.
Absolutely. And in that sense, were your family okay? You didn't sort of follow the dreams that they had for you, but did that all sort of like work out okay in the end? Did they, was there sort of an acceptance that, like, well, actually you're doing the right thing for yourself, or is that sort of, was that always a tension?
There's still a tension, but that's also because I'm still on that journey. So I think it's more some kind of anxiety yeah. that has to do with, is she going to find her place? Because this is something that we haven't talked about, and we won't have time to talk about it. But I think there's a lot of generational trauma that goes with, you know, being black in a white supremacist yeah. world, and this idea that I think yeah. part of the reason why they pushed me into that direction is because to them it was safe. Yeah. And I know that I was quite mad at them for a long while, but I do understand where they come from, and I do understand that they didn't want me to do that job because they really thought that I wouldn't find a place there, and, you know, the people there are from in the art world wouldn't let me. Yeah. So I do understand where they come from, and there's still that anxiety. Is she really going to find her place? Is she going to make enough money? Is she going to... So I was on the phone with my mother, and she's actually happy. She knows what I'm passionate about, and she's actually happy I'm doing this. When I got the internship and the National Portrait Gallery and the Beanie said, yes, we want you, she was very proud. But I'm in a period now of transition where I need to more or less leave teaching and take that big leap
yeah.
and get into that. Yeah.
yeah.
And she's a bit worried, I think. But, you know, if I make it somewhere, I'm pretty sure she will be reassured, and she will be
yeah.
certainly proud that I'm doing something.
Yeah.
Because we always have this conversation about, you know, doing things for future generations. And I feel like my parents, by doing what they've done, already paved the way for me. Yeah. And I want to do the same. I don't have children, but I want to pave the way for people like me and just be visible and have people who look at me and say, oh, well, we're represented, we belong there. I think what I lacked when I started and when I wanted to do that, and also my parents, I think if they had seen a black curator somewhere doing that, the kind of work I do, maybe they would have been less hesitant to let me do that. So I hope to be that person that would... persuade parents to let their children study, because that's, you know, that's possible, which yeah. is something that wasn't really possible yeah. conceivable
years
ago.
Yeah, and what you're saying is so inspirational. And I've met people like that who sometimes say, why do you do the things you do? Where's the money? What? And then they see somebody else doing it, and they might think, why don't you try your hand at that sort of thing? So you're like, well, hang on. So it's almost as though you're right. People, because if they haven't seen somebody do that, then there's no opening. But you've proven what you've done. And there may not be much money or whatever, you know. I'm very aware of those sort of conversations, you know, in terms of what some of the societal or family expectations that people have. But you've also proven that, you know, that there has to be why shouldn't you be the first person to do that?
Exactly.
And in that sense, what you've achieved, you know, goes way beyond what you could have done if you were one of many people doing the same thing, where you look or sound like other people doing the same thing.
And studying the same thing and doing the same thing. So I really do hope I will be that face that they will see and they will be able to tell themselves, yes, I can do this. Yeah. And I will be happy. And that happened at the Beanie as well. And I've had great people and who mentored me and really were really good listeners and gave me really good advice, and I would like in the future to do the same with curators who have the same values and the same objectives, and curate and create really things for future generations to look back years on, centuries, hopefully.
Well, I've got one more question for you, Sophie, which is, would you consider yourself to be a looking back or a looking forward type of person?
Both. I really don't have the choice. I'm not really looking forward. I mean, I think it has to do with my personality type and the fact that I'm a perfectionist. And I do look back a lot, and also a history and art history nerd. And I do look back a lot, and I want to understand the past. Because there's always this idea that if you understand the past, you will be able to do better, to understand the future, or just, you know, do things better in the future, or live better in the present. And also, I kind of ruminate a lot of what happened in the past, and I'm revising the past and try to analyze the past. So I do spend quite a lot. And also, when you curate, of course, and you research, you do spend quite a lot of time analyzing the context and doing all that history stuff and reading journals and reading books and memoirs. And so I do spend quite a lot of it, but it's really there. But it's really to look forward to the future and see, you know, what can I do? What can I take from the past to make the future better for me and for others? So it's really, I'm always in between, and it's always a dialogue between really the past and the future. And also, you know, I'm trying to learn how to live in the moment, which is quite hard.
That's actually a perfect answer. You've covered all the possible bases. But Anne-Sophie, what a wonderful experience to meet you. Thank you so much for being my guest this week.
Thank you so much for having me.